contact James live on the air several different ways. You can call by phone, toll free in the United States and Canada at 888-863-2722. If you have internet access, point your browser to www.feettofire.com. That's www.feet2fire.com. And check the left of the screen for the How to Participate text and click. You can then choose direct chat with James or join the official group chat room. You can send email to James at f2f@innersights.com. And now, live from Chicago, here is the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Yancic.
All right, we are back, and our next guest, Jan Ervin, interesting, very interesting person, GnosticMedia.com website, but especially interesting is the TriviumEducation.com website. Now, I heard Jan on a different show, and I was it was kind of a short interview, and I really liked it, and I really do want to talk to him, and he is here to talk about it. Now, it's interesting, because if you've known the show for a long time, we have I have a theme which is called, like, the road to truth via the path of non-contradiction. And then you follow the points of the, you know, if you connect the dots, that's fine. But if you find, look at the points that don't connect and start to rearrange your assumptions, then you can come up with something a little more accurate and you can weed out things. And that's what I've been going on for years, not being classically trained in the arts, knowing just some about the philosophers. In fact, I found out most about them posthumously, if you will, from the work that I've started doing here. So I was kind of encouraged that I was... kind of crudely, but nonetheless following this path. So when I listen to Jan speaking about the Trivium, it is a system that has been put together thousands of years ago by the Greeks and used to be able to weed out bad data and weed in, if you will, good data, which is right up our alley here at Feet the Fire. So I wanted to have him come talk about it. You can also find Jan Ervin on his Facebook page. Basically, you can get that from his web page. He is an independent researcher, author, lecturer, speaking on both academic and public venues. He has a podcast available, too, as well at GnosticMedia.com. He's the author of The Holy Mushroom, Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity, a critical reevaluation of the schism between the John M. Allegro and R. Gordon Wasson over the theory of entheogenic origins of Christianity presented in the Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And for more information, you can see that webpage, Holy Mushroom. And so I'd like to welcome to Feet the Fire, Jan Ervin. Welcome to the show, Jan.
Thank you, James. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, so I appreciate it. And so I was really, really excited hearing you talk about this Trivium, which I was all new to me, the title anyway, about how we can listen. See, I've always had the theory, and I've in my own life, is that you don't have to be a physics expert to understand principles of physics and actually find out things about physics that might be true or false. You don't have to be an expert in all the various disciplines. And what we have done in our world today is we're relying on expert opinion, which seems okay, but also there's a political alliances amongst those opinions that now tend to have science be more of a religion or a political stance rather than pure science and so on. And with this idea of being able to use logical deductions and whatnot, you can help weed out some of these things without having to be an expert. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that is basically to summarize. Yes, that is correct. And it's a systematic method that the ancients developed for driving certainty with information coming in via the five senses.
And so perhaps you can give us like an overview of a definition of trivium, what is it consisted of, et cetera.
All right, and for people that want to follow along, what I'm going to do is just go by some of the stuff on my website. That's triviumeducation.com, and trivium is spelled T-R-I-V-I-U-M, and that's triviumeducation.com. And a lot of people confuse the word trivium with trivia or trivial. They are not related. Trivium comes from Latin, meaning three roads crossing or three roads meeting. And it's a system that was developed primarily by Aristotle about 2,500 years ago. And the trivium is always taught specifically, well, it should always be taught specifically in this order. And we'll go into it more as we go here. But taken out of order, the trivium in and of itself becomes a system of mind control. But the trivium should always be taught as grammar, logic, and rhetoric. And grammar answers the question of who, what, where, and when of a subject. And it's based on discovering and ordering the facts of reality and comprises basic systematic knowledge, not only the rules of developed and applied knowledge in the ordering of word concepts for verbal expression and communication, but our first contact with conscious order as such. And basically, grammar is broken down into two parts, which is special grammar and general grammar. And people think, well, what would grammar possibly have to do with mind control, or why would it be anything that I would want to listen to on this Friday, you know, afternoon or Friday evening? And so what we're going to be doing is explaining how all of this stuff works and how they use these systems against you. And let me just state that understanding how the trivium works and getting explicit knowledge of it in your own mind is like installing a mental antivirus system. So we put mental antivirus systems on our computers, but we tend to leave our brains wide open to various malicious information. So anyway, the trivium is the system, the oldest system that we know of, and for that matter, the only system that we know of that works exactly how the mind works. So going back to grammar, special grammar deals with a specified language and the related parts, or, you know, the words, the letters, the grammar, punctuation, etc., of languages like English, Russian, or Latin, or whatever language that you're dealing with. And general grammar relates words to objective reality in any language and applies to all subjects as the first set of building blocks to integrated or fully mindful objective knowledge. So, in other words, general grammar, when you look outside at the world around you, you see tree or car or house or bird or book or computer, microphone. These are the objects that compose our reality. And so this is general grammar. And so, and then general grammar is made up of the parts of special grammar, basically. But when we're looking at items or studying things, information coming in via the five senses, we always look at grammar first. And grammar is the parts of a word, just like grammar could be the parts of a car or the parts of a model airplane or the building blocks to build a house or whatever you may be. These things are identified as grammar. And before you can build a car or a house or a model airplane or whatever you're dealing with, you have to know the parts.
Now, could this be called data as well? Could data be
an analog? Data, exactly. It's your data gathering. You're going out there, you're asking who, what, where, and when. You're getting all of the information together. What are the parts? You know, where's the glue? What is this? What is that? You know, where did it, or when does it need to be done by? These types of questions.
And
first built it?
And this would be limited to simple descriptors rather than making deductions or just
right.
Stuff like that.
Exactly. What you're doing is it's very raw. You're just identifying the things about you, the parts of the speech or the letters that you're using, the grammar, the parts of the car. Let's say you're working on your car, you know, over the weekend, and you've got all these parts laid out in your driveway and you're dealing with all these parts, you need to know the parts before you go to the parts store and ask them for replacement parts or whatever. And you have to have those identified before you can do so, before you can get the right parts to put them back in your car. So these, having the knowledge of the parts, is the basic foundation of all thinking. That's the very first step, other than the intuition of, hey, you know, I want to know about this thing. And then other than that first initiative instinctive step, everything else, the very foundation of all reality as far as spoken language and thought processes go is based on grammar.
And that's why it's important to not rule things out or in, but simply observe and catalog, and then later on you can work on those things.
Exactly. So that's exactly right. And the very next step of the trivium is logic, which answers the why of a subject. And I should also point out that grammar, you know, let me go back a step. Grammar is also known as knowledge, okay? So you have to have knowledge of the parts of speech or, you know, whatever that you're dealing with. You have to have knowledge of those parts first. And that knowledge is the who, what, where, and when. And knowledge is synonymous with grammar. And then understanding is synonymous with logic. And logic answers the why of a subject. And, of course, we've all heard who, what, where, when, why, and how. In fact, there's a cartoon that my son likes to watch where, you know, there's these little cartoon characters go around singing this song, who, what, where, when, why, and how. That's the trivium. That's the foundation of it all. So if you get that, you know, the very thing that we were taught out of, you know, we weren't taught who, what, where, when, and why out of order, but we were taught, we weren't taught how these things function as a system in grammar school, as we should have been. Grammar school, get it?
No, so, actually, when I've dealt with people on things, especially the one, for example, 9/11, I find that when I start talking about it, what they ask me right away is why. They're not even interested in the data. They want to go, wait a minute, right, why would they do this? You know.
Well, see, and what that's a very common problem. Many people, including philosophers, will put their logic first. In fact, even a lot of the books on the trivium out there that you can go and buy, and there's a really good book on the trivium that was written by a nun in the 1930s by the name of Sister Miriam Joseph, and she's got the trivium out of order. She tries to put logic first, and putting logic before grammar is like going to a restaurant and trying to eat your food before you've ordered from the menu, or before you've read the menu and told the waiter what you wanted. Or it's like trying to have a car that's all built and, you know, just instantly poof, it's there without having knowledge of the parts and how it went together and all of these things, where it came from, who did it, when they built it, all of this stuff, all the foundations of information that you need to put a car together. You know, a car just doesn't appear suddenly. You know, if you think about the history of a car, first there was a wheel, then they connected an axle, then there was a cart, then they took this cart and they put seats on it, and we had a buggy, you know, and then the buggy evolved into, you know, they would put nice interior and windows on it and things like that, and then eventually that turned into the horseless carriage or the first automobiles, and today we have the modern car. You didn't just suddenly end up with a car. You know, the grammar answers the cause and effect. Okay, so that's primary foundation knowledge. And what a lot of people do is they try and think of a subject like, you know, like you said with 911. Well, why would they do that? Instead of asking who, what, where, and when. In other words, let me get, rather than committing the fallacy of killing the messenger, you know, which Plato pointed out in his Allegory of the Cave more than 2,500 years ago, rather than killing the messenger, we ask these questions to get the data. You know, what data do you have? Who is involved? Where were they? When did all of this happen? I'd like to know the information.
And this would presuppose, though, that the people actually do want to know the real information rather than...
Well, see, that's part of having the trivium. See, if you have the trivium, you know that you don't kill the messenger, because you never know if that data that you're dismissing might save your life or whatever. You know, so the trivium, once you have it installed in your brain, it's always acting as a functioning system so that you're checking yourself. Okay, so then you can go back and you can say, well, you know, rather than just dismiss this information, I know that it's a fallacy on my part if I dismiss it out of hand, or if I call the person a cuckoo or a wacko, that's an ad hominem attack. If I, you know, there's many different fallacies that people will use to dismiss information. And so this is a key problem with people that put logic first. Like Ayn Rand, she's attacked relentlessly for a lot of her philosophies ending up being wrong. And for Alan Greenspan and the things that he did. And actually, if you watch Adam Curtis's new film, All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace, even though he blames Ayn Rand in that film, he admits that Alan Greenspan didn't go by Ayn Rand's philosophy and caved under pressure from the bankers and, you know, Wall Street, etc. But Ayn Rand did have valid philosophy. But the problem with Ayn Rand's research and work was that she had grammar and logic out of order. She would jump to conclusions before she gathered enough data to know for sure that what she was talking about.
Now, one of the things I noticed when I was reading Atlas Shrugged was that there was an assumption that, for example, the individual who was getting copper or the steel guy, I forget the names, that somehow they had a right to these items and own these items.
It's, you know, she uses a lot of appeal to authority fallacies. That would be an appeal to authority. This rich, wealthy guy, he's always going to know what's best for everyone, and he's always going to do what's in everyone's interest, never mind greed and humanity and humanness. Right. So she would jump to conclusions about how people act and things like that based on this logical idea without taking data in about, you know, how people really act, right? Mm. And so, you know, if she had studied works like Professor Carol Quigley or Anthony Sutton or Douglas Reed, she would never have come to the conclusions that she did about Europe or how the Soviet Union came about or how capitalism came about, you know, because she would have realized that capitalism and communism were a dialectic, that both of them were funded by the same groups, and there was no Soviet Union without the United States support. The history of it, and actually investigate, ask who, what, where, and when, then you discover that the Soviet Union was propped up by the United States from the get-go. And, you know, studying Douglas Reed will give you the answers on who the Bolsheviks were and their connections to various other groups. I don't want to go too deep into that now, but...
Right, okay.
So, you know, this is why you always put grammar before logic, so that you understand how concepts and ideas were developed. And you know, when somebody asks you, well, how do you know that, like Ayn Rand says, well, all Europeans are socialists. I lived in Europe for a year and a half, and I didn't find that to be true whatsoever. So, you know, she's, you know, and that's it's a hasty generalization. It's, you know, there's many fallacies involved in her conclusions with such ideas. So you have to realize that not all of her stuff is wrong.
Right.
Her logic and her grammar are out of order. So therefore, she came to false conclusions. But if you put them back into the proper order, you can still gain valid philosophy from her research. Just don't rely on many of her conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. So that brings us up to rhetoric, and rhetoric answers the how of a subject, and rhetoric is also synonymous with wisdom. So rhetoric is explaining to someone else how you built the car or the house or where you got your research from, what all the details are. You understand all those little parts. And logic, I should mention, is the art of non-contradictory identification. So once you've identified all of the parts under grammar, in logic, you remove all of the contradictions and make sure that your identifications are consistent and holistic and non-problematic.
Right? No, I want to stop there. Actually, I was going to ask you to go back to that because I either we didn't cover it, I missed it, but now you brought it up. The whole idea of non-contradiction, that alone, if someone were to simply look at their grammar, what they've come up, and look for contradictions, I think the world would change. It would be amazing because I've done a lot of studying in the fundamental Christianity. That's where I came from, and I started doing the reading of the doctrines of the various churches. And there's so many contradictions in there, and it's a matter of faith to accept the contradictions.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And so, you know, here's a that's a very, very poignant example that you just made. And so when there are all of these contradictions, they have to be removed. And once you've removed all of the contradictions or you can identify each path, what's going to happen is it's either going to inform you of what needs further research or what is false, and then you dismiss it.
Well, I find that a lot of people use the logic step of the argument here of this formula to go back and rearrange and weed out the grammar so that it looks like the way they want it to go.
Yeah.
You know, they actually use the logic to go back and restack the deck, if you will, before they move on to the next step.
So, yes, I would say that that's correct. And no matter how you look at it, by putting logic first, you're going to come to false conclusions because you're not fact-checking your data. And so things get out of order or restacked. And this is why having the trivium out of order is a system of mind control, just as not having it at all. And, you know, I should mention that being able to read is actually a system of mind control unless you have a systematic method for identifying false information coming into you while you are reading. In fact, Leo Tolstoy said that the printing press was a mighty machine for disseminating ignorance. And so, you know, and the first paragraph in Edward Bernays' book, in fact, I should probably read this to your audience so that they understand how what we're talking about fits into mind control and how everything operates. So going to Edward Bernays' book, Propaganda, this is chapter one, the first paragraph. The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. We are governed, our minds molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we have never heard of. This is the logical result, so he claims. This is their elitist, unlogical. This is from having their grammar and logic out of order because they put themselves above everybody else because they hoard the trivium and this information for themselves. This is the logical result of the way in which our democratic society is organized. Vast numbers of human beings must cooperate in this manner if they are to live together as a smoothly functioning society. And see, like I said, you know, the only way that they can operate things in this way is by the rest of us not having critical thinking and the tools to understand what's going on, and they count on us not having this information. So,
yeah, withholding the data, withholding the grammar, parts of the grammar, could actually have us draw the conclusion they want us to.
Well, exactly, because you put your logic first, and whatever Bill O'Reilly or Rush Limbaugh or whoever the case may be wants to tell you, you know, you eat it up, and you accept it as fact, and oh, you know, they wouldn't lie to me, you know, why would they lie to me, right? Instead of asking who, what, where, and when, and finding out the truth of the subject on your own and coming to your own conclusions based on the information yourself.
All righty, well, that's the music. We're going to take a break here, and we will come back as we continue talking to Jan Ervin. The trivium is the topic of discussion, the method of collating data, and then looking at that data for contradictions and whatnot, and then moving on to applying it. And we'll get to that last part, as well as many other aspects and applications of this system. It goes back a few thousand years. So this is not something that popped up in some newfangled idea, and it works for thousands of years, and has been used against us, and we prevented from even knowing it. So stay tuned. We'll be back, and we continue.
Are you getting your greens? I'm James Othianchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio. Now you can have your greens and drink them too with Innerfood by Inner Health Botanicals. Innerfood is 70% organic and 100% natural without fillers and is a whole food product totally assimilated by the body. Innerfood is spirulina, chlorella, dulse, kelp, spinach, alfalfa, barley, wheatgrass, rosehip, beetroot, and much more in real amounts. Not just a sprinkle to fill out an inflated but impotent list of ingredients. Just mix a tablespoon in your protein shake or in your favorite fruit juice and you are good to go and go and go. Other greens on the shelf typically weigh 300 grams and sell for between $35 and $70. Innerfood is a full 400 grams, 33% more, for $39.95 plus shipping. Simply go to our website, feedtofire.com, and click on any InnerHealth botanical banner and you're ready to order. Or call 866-762-9238 and be sure to mention you heard them on Feet to the Fire. Enter Food, building health from the insides out. Could you feed your family for a year, 2 years, or more from your garden if you had to? Do you have the right kind of seeds? Can you save your seeds from your harvest to plant next year? Heirloom Organics non-hybrid seed packs are a sustainable gardening choice of home, homestead, and professional gardeners throughout North America. Heirloom Organic Seed Packs are designed with your specific space, light, and nutritional needs in mind. A one-pound selection of 22 seed varieties that can feed two people for a year for just $99. Got a family? The Family Pack has 27 seed varieties to feed a family of four. There's even a Homestead Pack that has 31 varieties of seeds to feed eight people for 1 year for under $250. And don't forget, these are organically grown and 100% non-genetically modified. And forget the Terminator gene that prevents you from saving seeds for next year's crop. The heirloom organic seeds can be harvested and saved from each generation to be planted the next year. Just go to our website at feedtofire.com and click on the heirloom ad to access a lifetime of natural nutrition and wholesome eating the way it was meant to be.
Most people think of addictions relating to drugs, alcohol, and tobacco. However, obsessive compulsive actions taken to excessive levels have the same biochemical goal. They stimulate the creation of natural feel-good hormones, but at a cost that causes more harm in the long run. And prescribed drugs are often many times more dangerous and addictive than the symptoms they aim to treat. AddictionSupplements.com have proven supplements that supply the brain with the nutrients it needs to naturally rebalance the biochemical system, which is the real cure for the real cause. AddictionSupplements.com has cutting-edge supplements designed by real science and real doctors, such as Dr. Charles Gant, MD. Interested in turning your life around? Point your browser to AddictionSupplements.com.
Make sure you stay tuned, because you're listening to Feet to the Fire.
What does hurricanes, cyclones, tornadoes, blizzards, floods, earthquakes, volcanoes, civil unrest, martial law, and even the passage of Planet X have in common? The loss of electrical power. And when you stop to think about it, what aspect of our lives is not dependent on electricity? Time to think about solar and wind energies. Solar Sphere offers you a wide selection of solar-powered gadgets, chargers, and complete panel systems. And the Home Wind Company offers complete wind power from the smallest to the largest electrical needs, including do-it-yourself kits. Simply meander over to our website at feedtofire.com and look at the solar gadgets and the wind turbine ads and click your way to take back your power from the whims of weather, disaster, and politics. Generators only last as long as you have fuel. So turn to the sun at Solar Sphere and turn to the wind at Home Wind.
The walls came down. sanctuary fades, congregation splits.
Contact James live on the air several different ways. You can call by phone, toll free in the United States and Canada at 888-863-2722. If you have internet access, point your browser to www.feettofire.com. That's www.feet2fire.com. And check the left of the screen for the How to Participate text and click. You can then choose direct chat with James or join the official group chat room. You can send email to James at f2f@innersights.com.
The walls came down.
And now, live from Chicago, here is the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Yancic.
Back talking with Jan Ervin. Let me give you the websites here. TriviumEducation.com, Trivium, T-R-I-V-I-U-M, education.com. That's going to be kind of the notes for our talk today. GnosticMedia.com is where you can find out about Jan's various projects he's on, including the podcast and whatnot. And we are back with Jan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, and we should probably spell Gnostic for the audience as well, which is spelled G-N-O-S-T-I-C Media, and Gnostic is where we get the word knowledge from.
In Gnosko, that's true, I do assume things, and I've studied that from when I mentioned I was in these fundamental aspects. When I actually got the Greek and Hebrew scriptures or text, and I started to read textual criticism, and I started to go back into the actual word studies that go back hundreds of years, I said, whoa, there's a lot of stuff here that's been overlooked and not counted, which is very important. And that was my beginning of my personal awakening. And then I, of course, applied that to everywhere, science, politics, et cetera.
You know, a couple of points that we didn't discuss in the first segment there was what the Trivium, and there's also other parts of the Trivium. The Trivium isn't the only part. There's another segment of the Trivium called the Quadrivium, and then it goes upward from there as well. But the Trivium and Quadrivium are what is known today as the seven liberal arts, and what they teach us today in the colleges and universities is not the real seven liberal arts or the Trivium and Quadrivium, how it was originally taught. You can get, you know, some, you might find a good teacher or professor at some colleges and universities that still know it, and I do hear from professors now and then. You know, every couple of months I'll hear from a professor who teaches it to their classes. But this whole concept of the Trivium and Quadrivium and the seven liberal arts is very important, because the word liberal has, as I'm sure you know, has also been twisted to mean its antithesis. And, you know, today it's typically associated with communists or tax and spend liberals, or people that want to take your guns away and things like this. And this is absolutely the antithesis of what a liberal is. A liberal is somebody who basically has critical thinking of the classical seven liberal arts, which, as I mentioned, the first three that we already discussed was grammar, logic, and rhetoric. And then the next segment of the seven liberal arts is the quadrivium, which is arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. And it's
Let's stop for 1 second there. When you talk about liberal, being the opposite. Look at the word conservative. It's the conservatives who are polluting, destroying, you know, stealing, etc.
That's very true in its own sense. And
they're both, the way I put it is the left and right wings are connected to the same turkey, is how I put it.
If people are interested, I wrote an article that they can find under the articles link on the Gnostic Media website on the true definition of liberal, and I go into all of this, the history of the word there. But, you know, the word liberal comes from the Latin word liber, and liber, you know, is the Latin for also for book. And this is we store books in libraries or libraries, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so books in and of the books are synonymous with freedom. And so this is why getting an education in the classical seven liberal arts is so important to freedom. And I had said on other shows before that slaves were not allowed in Roman times to study the Trivium and Quadrivium, but a historian had actually contacted me and said that slaves were often used as teachers to teach the Trivium and Quadrivium to their master's children. So I stand corrected on that point, but the word liberal does come from the Latin book, and it is synonymous with freedom. And it also means of or befitting the free. And so wherever people get this idea that it means tax and spend or communist or take your freedoms and rights away, that's literally the antithesis of what a liberal is. And anybody who wants to do those things to you, they are not a liberal, they're not for freedom, and they should stop associating themselves with what is the true a true liberal. But I also wanted to say that the quadrivium is also always taught in that specific order.
Well, actually, before we stop here, can we just touch back on rhetoric for a minute? Rhetoric has been ruined as well by the word. When you hear people say, all this rhetoric, et cetera.
Oh, sure. And rhetoric, there's good rhetoric and there's bad rhetoric. And, you know, and I will go back to that for a second, but I just want to explain a little bit, you know, the whole of the seven liberal arts, and then we'll go back and explain rhetoric a little bit more. And then we'll go into some of the logical fallacies. But again, the quadrivium is arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy, and it's always taught in that order. And the reason why it's taught in that order is because mathematics or arithmetic is number in itself, which is a pure abstraction or number outside of space and time. And then geometry is number in space. Music or harmonic theory is number in time. And then astronomy is number in space and time. So by having these things in this order, one builds off the last. Logic builds off of grammar, rhetoric builds off of logic, and actually the golden ratio connects the trivium and the quadrivium together. And then before you go in and you understand, or before you study mathematics and geometry, music, and astronomy, you have this foundation of how to learn things on your own, the systematic method of fact-checking things and understanding things and removing the contradictions before you go on to study the higher arts of the quadrivium. And then from there, it'll go into philosophy and that sort of stuff. But the ancient philosophers believe that you should never study philosophy without having a firm understanding of the trivium and quadrivium, and you would completely misunderstand philosophy if you did so. So having the trivium and quadrivium were core, and in fact, to enter Plato's school, I forget what exactly it said, but it was regarding the triangle, which is the trivium, and so it wasn't just about understanding math. It was about having the foundation of the trivium before you could enter the university.
I just imagine if I go back to my own education, and I actually liked the math and the sciences in particular, and if this concept was taught and having mathematics and geometry, et cetera, as being components in it, that would have been a way more powerful than just simply teaching math or science or geometry or, you know.
Well, sure, and that's the whole idea is to segment these subjects so that people aren't polymaths. They don't have a lot of knowledge from different areas. Everything is segmented, and this is also doing so leads to the current PhD system where you get people that are very singly and narrowly focused and often don't get the big picture because of their narrow focus and, you know, refusing to go back and gather enough grammar, enough data, and then remove the contradictions before they come to conclusions, right? So having this narrow focus, you know, in some aspects it's necessary because we have so much knowledge and information today, but being trained to only have to be singly focused or being raised that way does not benefit humanity or the academic.
Well, I think the way it was supposed to be was you get, you know, when you go to high school, college, you get this general kind of rounded education, and then you branch out into your specialty. So at least you have a certain level of commonality, whereas they're starting out right out in high school, right out to college, being specialized right away.
Right, and there is no commonality anymore in anything, and most of the people coming out of high school have no critical thinking, you know. And I hear people say, "Well, I have critical thinking," you know, and most people don't really have critical thinking. I mean, you'll have some level inherent that's natural to you, you know, some ability to critically think, but unless you have a systematic method that you've intentionally adopted and installed, you don't have critical thinking, and that's what the trivium is. And the trivium, once you learn it and start hearing it and studying it, your brain starts adapting it and applying it right away because it is the natural method that the brain works. So,
if we had a properly installed trivium, there would be no magicians because all their tricks would be analyzed to figure out what makes them, you know, what the illusion is.
Exactly, and that would be.
We have no politicians, for sure.
That would be more of the trickery type of quote-unquote magic.
Right. That's what I should refer to, the illusionist or whatever.
Exactly. You know, and then there's alchemy and a lot of other ancient arts that are a little bit deeper than trickery. But
when I look back at this grammar, logic, rhetoric as you go forward, to me it looks like the first thing you have to really be honest and committed to is finding, if you really want to find truth. I use truth two ways, with a capital T and a little t. Little t is what we believe is true in the meantime while searching for capital T, and it's constantly being updated because we find more data, and therefore we work back into backtrack and change and so forth. But if you don't really want to know truth, it's kind of like it doesn't matter. And I have found a shocking, myself included, everything I look back in my life, I see at one point in my life, I didn't want to know truth. I wanted to know what fit in with my worldview, even though I couldn't have put it that way at the time. But
this is because we've given our thinking over to authority, over to media pundits and to politicians and these types of people, rather than thinking for ourselves, because we no longer have the trivium and critical thinking. We've given our thinking over to someone else. That's it, you know, it's as simple as that, really.
And I found that when I was in conflict in the church, and when I was talking to a PhD psychologist, the head of Olivet Nazarene University in the psychology, and I brought up stuff that stumped him, and I'm going, wait a minute, I'm a college dropout. I didn't like college at all because all it was is taught me how to think like someone else. And I can see better than this guy can, who is, you know, head of a university. And that was another opening eye. It's like, do you want to know truth? Do you want to really look at all the data? Or are you going to look for stuff to fill your worldview? And I think, how do we get someone to really look into that? I mean, how does that happen? How does somebody all of a sudden go, you know, I want to know truth? Don't they have to be like, their paradigm shattered or something?
Yes and no. I mean, people have to decide to wake up, really. The people that don't care to know truth are what the elites call the dead, and they're the masses. They're the what's another word for them? Anyway, the dead and the masses are two general terms. The profane is another one. Mm-hmm. But these are people that they're ignorant, right? And ignorant, someone who is ignorant is someone who intentionally ignores something and chooses another option, right? So what they're doing is they're intentionally blocking out information, which is to ignore it. And they're rather than verifying all data coming in from the five senses, okay, asking who, what, where, and when, and then removing the contradictions, which is the
logic,
the how, yeah, or the why, excuse me, and then before expressing any ideas or concepts to someone else in their decisions or thoughts, their rhetoric, right? So these are people that don't verify anything in their reality. They put their logic first.
Right. So, I mean, one of the things we're talking about here right now, what this show is for and what you're talking about, and luckily a lot, really most of the listeners I talk to want to know truth. Otherwise, they would be somewhere else just getting, you know, a cheerleader, some website that would just tell them what they want to hear. But, you know, I go out in the world and it's just very rare. It's very rare. And, you know, I'm stuck between, all right, is it my job as someone who can see these things and I'm constantly learning and constantly growing and constantly finding previous contradictions, et cetera? Is it my calling as an awakening human to try and awaken others? Or do I just kind of leave it out there and whoever comes to drink, fine? How do you find out when you do this?
Basically, you can, as the old saying goes, bring a horse to water, but you can't make him drink, right? And so it really comes down to the individual, and basically all you can do is put the information out there, and then those who are ready for it and are hungry for learning and understanding, or who are just tired of the mundane and you know all the crud going on around them, when people are ready, they will pick it up. And it's actually a way that you can test the true integrity of someone, right? If you offer someone the trivium, or if you set it there on the table, and you know, and if they immediately take interest in it, or what have you, then that's an inquisitive mind. And then furthermore, you can also identify if somebody has motives for the greater good or selfish motives by how they react once they discover what the trivium really is. If they want to hide it and keep everything for themselves, you know, you could take control of a lot of people with the trivium in a malicious fashion by you having it and others not having it. You know, bosses at jobs might want to try and get it. So this is why it's important to put it out there to as many thousands or millions of people that we can, so that we're empowering everyone and we're leveling the playing field, so that you don't have this group of elites or, you know, bosses or whatever that want to control others with it and use it to their own advantage. So that's literally what the trivium meme is leveling the playing field for everyone, because the only way the trivium, and a lot of the occult for that matter — the occult means something hidden — but the only way these tools can be used against you is by your ignorance of them. And so you know they're there, you choose to ignore them. This is how they become tools that can be used against you.
Let me ask you then, I have found a test that I would make with someone, or if I would observe this an individual, that if they react to I don't want to word challenge, but I guess it's how it's received. If they react to a challenge, to a position they're in with emotion, that would kind of be a red flag that they're using the logic prior to the grammar. Would that be
Well, not necessarily. It's just somebody who doesn't have it at all, really. But, you know,
well,
see, the
I
thing
mean,
is... I mean, see, the thing is, somebody who reacts emotionally doesn't necessarily have an ulterior agenda. Okay?
Right. Well, that's true. They don't have to have an ulterior agenda, but they're kind of attached to their position beyond that they're resting on their position because it seems to be the truth.
Well, they're not necessarily even putting logic first in that case. They're just reacting on at an even more base level, like animal instinct.
Okay, because I what I have done in trying to weed out people to waste my time.
Well, see, like someone like going back to Ayn Rand, she would be someone who you could say puts her logic first. She's not putting. She recognizes not to think with emotion, though. Okay. But emotion is more of just, a child reacts with emotion. And the child hasn't developed the tools to gather data and think logically yet. So, okay. They're more acting on a primary animalistic or, I hate to use the term now because it's so misused now by the Ike people. But, the lizard brain level, mm-hmm. This would be that level where you're reacting emotionally with that animal instinct, and not thinking critically and not thinking detached.
Because I have found people who are, their personhood is identified with a belief system. I mean, this could be political. I mean, I'm not just picking on the church, but if their their personhood is attached to that.
Sure, absolutely. Very many people, whether they're Hindu or Christian or Jewish or Zionist or what have you, a lot of people do identify with these types of beliefs, and it's they're typically not to use a hasty generalization fallacy, but often they're people who don't have critical thinking and haven't really looked at who, what, where, and when of where their religions or political belief systems came from. Republicans and Democrats, when you get into studying logic and Hegel, you'll see really quickly that Republicans and Democrats is a Hegelian dialectic. It's the left and right. Somebody is controlling both paradigms to their own goal at the end, and they get all the masses to buy into one or the other, or even libertarian for that matter. And and then you have these, the Communist Party and all of these, and
right,
to me, why be a part of any of them when the only thing that you should be concerned for is truth? And because these politicians and their lies and their fallacious logic do have an impact on all of us. And what we should do here is segue into the logical fallacies, because
we got about a minute and change before we have to break.
So all right. So let's go into the logical fallacies then after the break. But
okay. Well, let me ask you one thing quickly inside here. The reason why I bring this up is because I have a lot of scars, physical and mental, emotional, otherwise, because being one searching for the truth and dealing with people, assuming that they too want the truth, but are passively blind.
What happens is when we approach things like that, it took me years to figure this out because I did it myself, but we end up whacking at the branches. Okay, so rather than approaching people with what we consider the truth or all of this information that we've gathered, all of these branches like 9/11 or education being corrupt, or Iran, Iraq, all of this stuff, all of these different things going on, pollution and water and everything else, what we need to learn to focus on is giving people the tools for critical thinking first, and then they, by properly thinking, will realize all of the other stuff is going on their own. So give them the roots to cut down the tree of the problem rather than whacking at the branches.
Well, very, very well, very well said. Excellent. Okay. Well, hold on. We'll take a break. We'll continue back with Jan Irving on the Trivium and whatnot, which will talk about critical thinking, and actually the truth does set you free. So hold on. We'll be right back.
Kawaita is an owner-operated independent drivers association that unites commercial drivers and equipment owners, empowering them with a collective force in the economical, social, and political arena. For over 35 years, the Owner-Operators Independent Drivers Association have been fighting for the rights of all professional drivers. I know. I'm a member myself. For more information about OIDA, visit their website at www.oida.com. OIDA, a united voice standing strong for your freedoms.
The Berkey Water System is more than a water filter. It's a natural purification system that yields 99.99% pure toxin and biopathogen-free water from any water source without electricity. Many supermarket paper and charcoal filters catch, for a while anyway, some impurities that make water taste bad. The Berkey ceramic hard rock filters with their zillions of little micro holes go much further and trap everything from parasites to bacteria to chemical toxins and molecular size contaminants, even fluoride and arsenic. Trace elements and minerals necessary for life are filtered out by most reverse osmosis systems. The Berkey systems allow these through to nourish and energize you, your family, your pets, and the plants under your care. What about lugging bottled water home every week? The Berkey Pure Water Systems are many times more pure than the so-called spring water, and the cost-convenience factor will amaze you. With simple, regular cleanings, your Berkey system can last up to 6,000 gallons between filter replacements. That means pure water at your fingertips for under 2 cents a gallon. Our friends at Inner Health Botanicals are committed to providing natural, safe, and effective supplements and supplies to help you be your healthiest. Just go to feedtofire.com and click on the Berkey Water ad or call 866-762-9238 and make sure you tell them you heard about it on Feet to the Fire. Real clean water at a real nice price. Oh, yeah.
70 million Americans suffer from sleep deficit. I'm James Othayanchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio, and I'd like to tell you about Earth Pulse Magnetic Field Supplementation. While using your Earth Pulse device, I found that I drifted off to sleep faster, I slept deeper, and I woke up more refreshed, and it does much, much more. Call them right now at 888-211-7888 or check out their website at www.earthpulse.net.
But wait, there's more. When you buy a new digitally programmed Earth Pulse version 4 magnetic supplementation device and use the special Feet to the Fire coupon code F2F, you'll receive an instant $50 savings. No rebates to get lost in the mail. Just $50 more in your pocket on your way to better health.
888-211-7888. Or check out their website at earthpulse.net.
And use the special Feet to the Fire coupon code F2F.
Earth Pulse. Deeper, more restful sleep or your money back.
I'm James Othayanchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio and creator and host of Feet to the Fire. Have you ever noticed the high volume of commercials on most talk shows? It is to the point that it seems like topics are the bait and the guests are the fillers to sell products. I've made a conscious decision to keep disruptions to a minimum and provide more uninterrupted time for the real reason you tuned in. You hear guests with more time to make their points, allowing me and listeners to intuitively, intelligently formulate questions by having less interruptions to break the stream of consciousness. Feet to the Fire may be free to listen to, but it's not free to provide. We rely heavily on donations to offset the expenses of producing the show. If you like what we are doing and enjoy the show, why not consider donating via PayPal or a major credit card from our website, feettofire.com.
Or write us at Feet to the Fire, P.O. Box 511, Minooka, Illinois, 60447. Thank you.
Back into it all over again. Are you people in motion? You better get it together or we won't get it done. We sit by while you fuss and fuss. But this is us, there's nobody but us. Now we're a dedicated people and we'll do our job. But the harder we work, the getting gets hard. One for all and all for one. For it's harder to live when you can't have fun.
we carry the funk. And that's been fair, so stop rocking the boat. You think you get away with political crimes, but don't take it for granted, they're still on our mind. Not some of the people, some of the time, but not all of your people, all of the time. Trent Dickin, Ford King, a Jimmy Mac Carter, Ronnie Reagan too.
You can contact James live on the air several different ways. You can call by phone, toll free in the United States and Canada at 888-863-2722. If you have internet access, point your browser to www.feettofire.com. That's www.feet2fire.com. And check the left of the screen for the How to Participate text and click. You can then choose Direct Chat with James or join the official group chat room. You can send email to James at f2f at innersights.com. That's f2f at innersites.com. There is a video chat room to see James in action, as well as other F2F listeners. www.ivisit.com has the free software to download and access the Feet to Fire video chat room. And now, live from Chicago, here is the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Yancic.
All right, we are back. And we're talking with Jan Ervin about the trivium and critical thinking, and that's how you can tell if someone's talking out the side of their neck. What a great phrase. I love it. I would love to be able to go to one of the politicians and just say, hey, you're talking out the side of your neck. We are back talking with Jan Ervin and the website's Gnostic Media. That's a G, of course, at the beginning. TriviumEducation.com. And welcome back, Jan.
Thank you, James.
So I guess we're talking fallacy. I was going to ask you to get to some of those, because I think when people start to apply this, if they have some preloaded fallacies, pre-proven preloaded fallacies, that would make life a lot easier.
Oh, absolutely. And, the fallacies are really fun, because once you know them, you can start applying them right away. And the reason why fallacies are important to know, well, not only, they're a part of logic, but knowing the fallacies takes information and turns it from implicit to explicit knowledge. There we go. Okay. It was there somewhere. All right. So and once you take implicit to explicit, then you can actually name something. So let's just state right up front that logical fallacies, or Latin fallare, are ways that people lie. Now, there's people who don't know that they're lying, who are passing on lies or fallacies that they heard. And, those are people that are just ignorant of the seven liberal arts and how to properly critically think. And then there are those who pass on false information intentionally, and those are called sophists. And sophists or sophism is also where we get the word sophisticated, which, guess what? Those are the elites, right? So someone who intentionally uses these types of fallacies and this information, once again, as a sophist.
Now,
so,
if I can just stop just for my own personal self here, isn't that kind of what Aristotle thought about him? Because when I was studying into Socrates and trying to get back into the sophist, wasn't there like a good sophism and bad sophism?
There, that is very true. There is a good sophism and a bad sophism. And the two types of sophism are based on Isocrates and Demosthenes, okay? And Demosthenes is the bad branch. Demosthenes died in 322, and he is associated with none other than Skull and Bones.
Ah, there you go.
So this is where Skull and Bones gets their 322 from. It's from Demosthenes, who was the bad sophist. But typically today, sophism in general, I mean, you know, there are ways to use it positively, but sophism in general is looked at using false rhetoric and the logical fallacies to manipulate people for your own gain.
Right. I would agree that is what it is today, yeah.
Okay, so let's go back to the fallacies here. And there's two types of fallacies, informal and formal. Formal fallacies are based strictly on the logical formation of an argument, which is deductive, and it's looking at and analyzing written words of language. Informal fallacies, which are the most common and easiest to learn, take in non-logical content of an argument, and it's more inductive. And the logical fallacies, the informal as we have them today, came to us from Sir Thomas Aquinas and the Scholastics. So let's say, and I mentioned ad hominem earlier, but let's say you're trying to explain a conspiracy to someone, and they say, well, you're just a conspiracy theorist. You know, and they've heard this word theorist attached to conspiracy since it was attached to the word conspiracy in the 90s primarily. It didn't appear in the dictionary until the last 20 or 30 years. But so what they did was to take people's attention away and to get them to stop asking who, what, where, and when, they put the word theory on to the word conspiracy. But anybody who walks into a courtroom or anything like that knows that conspiracies are tried every day and filed every day, and conspiracies are very common. And in the political arena, you know, as well, anybody who's ever read a history book, they'll realize very quickly that the conspiracies are adamant. So if you're trying to explain something to someone and they say, well, you know, James, you're just a conspiracy theorist, or you're a tinfoil hat wearing fool, that's an ad hominem attack, which is an attack on the man. Rather than dealing with the information that you're trying to present, they're killing the messenger, they're calling you whatever name, and then using that name to dismiss the information, rather than properly gathering and analyzing the data before they come to a conclusion. So another one is an appeal to authority. And, you know, there's improper and proper use of the appeal to authority. If you're making a claim on, say, the latest discovery in astronomy, and you reference Dr. E.C. Krupp at Griffith Observatory, and you're saying, you know, this is the latest, I just got this from Dr. E.C. Krupp, you know, you can, unless Dr. Krupp is specifically the you know, what's being put under question, you can probably say that that's an okay appeal to authority. But if you say, you know, well, Joe Schmo says that the moon is made of cheese, you know, you should probably not buy into that appeal to authority there. Appeal to belief is another very common one, and there's many appeal to. You know, and one thing I forgot to mention very quickly here, I'll go back. There are three categories that the informal fallacies all fall under, which are relevance, presumption, and ambiguity. Okay, so that's important to, you know, it just helps to simplify. And some people prefer, rather than to know all of the different fallacies, which I like to know, they prefer to only know the three basic categories.
Actually, if I can ask you about the ambiguity as an example, I get email from various people on Planet X, which is allegedly in our solar system very close, and I'll get emails that are 6 and 7 pages long, single typed, and there's nothing in it. There's just all this
stuff.
Oh, sure.
It's well, it's but appeal to belief. It's a lot of stuff.
And when I distill it,
it's not. It's, you know, an ambiguity fallacy would be like when Obama says, you know, we have enough intelligence to act on something, right? So does he say, which would be the ambiguity there would be, if you break it down further, it's the fallacy of equivocation, which means the word intelligence is being used ambiguously. Does he mean I have enough personal intelligence to decide this or that, you know, meaning I'm smart enough? Or is he talking about CIA intelligence and FBI intelligence, right?
Right.
So, or Secret Service intelligence. So there's, you know, so this would be more of the type of fallacy of ambiguity, which, like I said, you can break it down further to analyze, you know, further than that, that it's the fallacy of equivocation. So going back to appeal to belief, this is a very common one. If you don't do this, God is going to come down and whack you or do this to you, strike you dead. That's an appeal to belief. Appeal to common practice. Well, you know, this is the way we always do it, and this is the way that we're going to do it. I don't care if there is a better way. Shut up. This is the way it's always been done, which is also an appeal to tradition, you know, which, you know, this is how the country has always been run, or my family's always believed in this religious tradition or whatever. It's the same type of idea. There's also appeal to fear.
Boy, we see that at all these days.
Oh, yeah. you know, Obama loves to use appeal to fear. You know, if we don't go out and kill these Arabs that we armed called Al-Qaeda, they're going to row a canoe across the Atlantic and bomb us into oblivion, right? So this would be an appeal to fear. There's an appeal to flattery. You walk into work in the morning and your boss says, "Hi, James, you know, that's a great-looking suit and a nice haircut you got today, and you must be really ready to kick some ass here at work today," right? So this would be an appeal to flattery, appeal to novelty. Terence McKenna is famous for this one. He based his whole time wave theory on habit and novelty. So in a way, always saying that nature goes for novelty, that's the appeal to novelty fallacy. And then there is appeal to pity. Appeal to popularity. You know, if you buy this car, you're going to have all the girls. If you drink this beer, you're going to have the prettiest girls and this and that. Another one that's kind of part similar to an ad hominem is the appeal to ridicule. And I really like this one because it's basically saying that, you know, James, you're wrong because ha ha, ha ha ha. And that's it. So, you know, rather than providing a valid answer, there's, "Oh, well, that's absurd."
Oh, I see. Okay. I was actually looking at that statement logically, and it didn't make any sense, but I get you.
Right. Yeah. It's their answer is literally, or their response is literally, "It's absurd because ha, 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 ha." So, you know, appeal to spite. We already covered appeal to tradition. There's the bandwagon fallacy. Which back in the old days, politicians would put a band on a wagon and they would pull the wagon around town and, you know, drum up lots of attention. And so you wanted to be a part of the bandwagon and a part of the group. So it's an appeal to popularity, but it's more commonly bandwagon fallacy. Begging the question. Now, there's another really good and popular common fallacy that is used very often, especially in religious circles. And begging the question is also known as circular reasoning or circular logic. So let's say I say, "Well, you know, I believe in God and I have this Bible right here. And, you know, this Bible was written by God himself." And I say, "Well, how do you know that?" And you say, "Well, it says so right here in the Bible." See, well, this you can't go back to the same source to prove your original statement. You have to find external supportive evidence to support your statement. So this is begging the question or circular logic. By a sample is when you, let's say, you know, you claim that all Republicans want XYZ, but you only interview Republicans that want XYZ, or you intentionally leave out certain demographics, or you don't admit that certain Republicans answered a question otherwise.
It's funny you say that, because there was a case when they had a Republican debate with Ron Paul was in it. They had a CNN poll, and the poll was about 70% in favor of Ron Paul, so they used the MSNBC poll, which had 30 votes, which had him getting only a few percent, and they substituted that instead. That was a kind of a
oops, that got out in the public, and then they showed both of the polls.
Yeah, by a sample. And burden of proof. If I make a claim, it's my burden of proof to support that claim, to provide evidence. And, you know, I need to, you know, if I say that Judeo-Christianity is based on magic mushroom use and, you know, all these psychedelic religious practices, I better be able to support that claim. And, you know, I mention that because I've written two books on that very subject, and I've provided ancient primary texts and, you know, ancient icons from different Bibles and churches and things like this. And it's it was a theory that was originally proposed in 1970 by John Allegro, and now it's pretty much we have the burden of proof now that we didn't have, or we have the proof now 40 years later that we didn't have in 1970. Circumstantial ad hominem is another common fallacy. It's basically saying that, well, you know, you have a radio station, and so therefore anything you have to say about how internet radio shows should be run or whatever is biased, or you're against this bill to limit podcasters on the internet, so therefore you're biased. That's a circumstantial ad hominem.
No, actually, let me stop there for a second. And I'm not disputing that, but when they have the head of the FDA being a lawyer from Monsanto, shouldn't one kind of raise their eye and say, wait a minute, is this guy really going to be fair?
Well, is that the same? You do have to look into that, and you have to see if the person has a special interest or not. So you do have to be careful with that.
I guess just to assume not would be incorrect, but it's not an unreasonable question.
Well, if somebody just blurts that out, you know, you have to question it and verify that information and not just say, oh, well, in that case, I'm not going to believe anything that person says. You know, what you should do is go and ask that person themselves and see what their position is regarding that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to skip down a couple. There's the middle of the road fallacy, which is or middle ground fallacy, which is a very common one. Person X proposes a solution that's valid. Person Y, even though it's a valid solution, doesn't like person X's solution, so he provides an invalid solution. And then a politician comes along and says, well, you know, we just got to go with the middle of the road or the middle ground fallacy, you know, and that's going to be the right answer. Well, no, it's not the right answer because wrong is wrong. Okay. So, you know, if person X was the only one that provided the right answer, going with the middle of the road doesn't give you a right solution. It gives you a wrong solution. And politicians are famous for middle of the road fallacies. Gambler's fallacy is another popular one. You walk into a casino and you see somebody at a slot machine pulling the lever for an hour, and then they get up and they walk away, and you say, aha, well, that person just played that slot machine for an hour. I'm going to use it because they just walked away. Well, they count on you to do this because it doesn't matter if that slot machine has been played for an hour or 10 hours or 100 hours and didn't win, because if that slot machine, if every single pull on that handle has a 1 in 100,000 chance of winning, it doesn't matter if that last person sat there all week or not, because every single pull is going to have the exact same chance of winning.
You know, that's a great thing, and I've talked to people about the lottery. There's people who buy 100 lottery tickets, and they think their chances are much better. And I said, well, and I give examples. You roll the dice six times. What are the odds of getting a six in the sixth roll? And it's 1 in 6. I mean, you know, you might look at a big picture and say, well, over time things even out. But in any given roll, any given lottery, every given thing, you have the full mathematical weight of the odds.
With each specific ticket purchase.
Each ticket is you know, has that. So if you have 10 of those, or 20 tickets, you have 20 chances out one of 140 million or whatever the lottery is, you know.
Right, and you only increase it by that 20 chances, yeah. You know, but each ticket in and of itself has the same exact chance of winning.
Right, and it's sad because, you know, because the odds are so high that you're better off buying one ticket than that's it. Because anything more than that is you're making it even worse, not better. You know, so I tell people, hey, you want to buy one ticket? Okay, it's worth a buck. It's like a cup of coffee. You want to take a chance? Somebody wins, fine. But if you think that you can somehow better your odds on it, I mean, it's outrageous. It's ridiculous. And of course, they want you to do that.
All right, let's go for some more of these here. Okay. Let's go with guilt by association. That's a common one. Your brother committed a crime, therefore everyone in your family is a criminal. Or your best friend raped this girl, so therefore you're a rapist. That type of thing.
I guess that's where racism would come in under that category.
It could be, yes. Not always, but yes. Mm. And that's also known as poisoning the well, right? Like, let's say if I am working on something and I get one answer wrong, and even though I got 50 other answers right, you look at this one thing that I got wrong and you say, oh, well, that guy's an idiot. He doesn't get anything right. Mm. That's poisoning the well. That's saying that anything that that person or that group does is wrong or invalid. There is a genetic fallacy, which is a false origins. There's guilt by association. I just did guilt by association. There's a hasty generalization, which is when you come to a conclusion on something without gathering enough data first. All blacks are criminals, okay? Well, you know a couple of blacks that committed a crime and they were thrown in prison and they're the only blacks that you knew and you've never gone out to analyze this in detail, but you say, oh, you know what, all blacks are criminals and they should be locked up. You know, never mind all the ones that all the blacks who are perfectly outstanding citizens contributing wonderfully to our lives and everything around us.
Actually, that's a great one, because if you were using an obvious fallacy there. If you were to say something like, well, you know, 70% of young black males are incarcerated. It's some high number like that. I'm not sure exactly what the number is. Compared to other races, therefore, blacks are more likely to be incarcerated, black males. But you have to go further and say, you know, what's the economic conditions? Why is there a higher percentage? Is because of being funneled into a particular type of poverty, et cetera, et cetera.